All right, I'd like to ask Chris and the first panel to take their seats. And just as an aside, Patrick Bolli, our student who's graduating this year, is from Manitoba, not Saskatchewan, but there you go, close enough.
Good morning again. I'm glad to be able to open this first panel of the conference. I'm not going to take up very much time. I'll just say a quick word of introduction of our four panelists. We have very good bios of them in your package. At my left is Ian Brody, good sense to attend McGill University as an undergraduate, received his EA, went off and got his PhD at another reasonable institution with which I'm affiliated, won't mention name. Was a professor at the University of Western Ontario and then served in the Prime Minister's Office Chief of Staff till 2008. Very pleased he's come to spend this term with us at MIST. To his left is Wendy Thompson, the director of the Professor of Social Policy, director of the School of Social Work at McGill City, who was before that position served under Prime Minister Tony Blair in the UK. To her left is Matthew Mendelson, who is the founding director of the Mowat Center for Public Policy Innovation at Queen's University and spent some time as a PM in the government of Ontario. And to his left, the Right Honourable Joe Clark, Prime Minister of Canada, leader of the Progressive Conservative Party, spent 2 years working with us with the Center for Developing Area Studies, a professor of practice. They're here to talk to us a little bit about evidence and policy making. We're going to run from the particular to the general with Ian and Wendy talking about a couple of case studies, one from Canada, one from Great Britain, and then Matthew and Joe talk a little bit about some general concerns. So I'm just going to turn the floor over to Ian to talk about Justine.
Thank you. You want me to talk from here?
Where do I talk from here?
Thank you for that. I appreciate the chance to talk today about the role of evidence in policymaking. It's an interesting and timely conference, and I'm particularly pleased to be here with so many practitioners and students of public policy, and especially of a panel of people who have mixed the study and practice of public policy during the course of their careers. During my time as a practitioner of public policy in Harper's government, I was piqued from time to time to see our government attacked by students of public policy for embarking on policies that some have thought lacked a firm basis in evidence. Every time, for example, we proposed amendments to the criminal code, sociologists, criminologists, lawyers, and others attacked us for...
All the same.
Well, you can draw your own conclusion. Attacked us for proposing measures that the evidence apparently showed did not work. It was a good thing for us politically that sociologists, criminologists, and defense lawyers were and are all held in lower repute than conservative politicians by the voting public. Politically, it helped us tremendously be attacked by this coalition of university types. But we never really had to engage properly in the question of what evidence actually shows about various approaches to crime. The committees who noticed rising rates of youth and violent crime came to the common sense conclusion that whatever was being done to tackle it was not working. More persistent, though, and more irksome to me, were the various economists, or people claiming to know economists, who were critical of our proposal to reduce GST from 7 to 6 to 5%. This was a key part of our 2005-2006 election platform. And since I played a key role in drafting that, I got to take some responsibility for defending it. Now that I'm out of government, I can. We were, of course, in the first part of that commitment in the spring 2006, on the second part of that commitment in the fall 2007. The opponents of the GST made a rather interesting case. They claimed the GST was a waste of money. It would be better for us to use that money to reduce corporate taxes or to move the personal income tax brackets around or cut personal income tax rates. That kind of tax cut would have, apparently, according to economists, at least people who claim to know economists, improved Canada's productivity or innovation or otherwise have helped strengthen the Canadian economy in ways that cutting the GST would not have. Because in the end, the folks who attacked us believed there were such a thing as good taxes and bad taxes, and the government should cut bad taxes before it goes into good taxes. There, I understand, a plausible theoretical case would be made here that taxing income and profits tends to depress income and profits, that taxing consumption tends to depress consumption, and that since we apparently desire more income and profits, we should cut those taxes first, and since we do not desire an increase in consumption, we should leave those consumption taxes alone. I also gather there's some evidence to show that this might all work out in practice the way it works in theory. So why then do we commit to cutting the GST so much? It's after all a mass chunk of money off of the federal budget. The GST cut was the single most expensive promise in the 2005-2006 campaign by an order of about 20 compared to the next most expensive one. You understand that requires some of the evidence from the field of political marketing rather than economics, I'm afraid. In the fall of 2005, when we started down the path of toppling the Mark government, we knew we were going to have a platform that promised some kind of tax relief. We had proposed a massive tax cut in the 2004 election campaign, one largely signed by economists and people who claim to know economists. We promised a comprehensive system of moving brackets around, cutting brackets, multi-year this, multi-year that, the corporate income tax that as well. A plan so well thought through that even the people who wrote cannot remember the details of it now, and although I campaigned on it, if you pressed me, I couldn't quote a single piece of it. When we talked about it, all Canadians heard was yet another political party talking about more tax cuts. And here's the problem. By the fall of 2005, the real problem here was that Canadians had been hearing about tax cuts for the better part of a decade, and hardly any Canadian believed that he or she had seen any changes in their taxes as a result. We had trouble finding Ontarians who thought that Mike Harris had cut their taxes. We had trouble finding Albertans who thought that Ralph Klein had cut their taxes, except maybe for the first year of his government. And we could find no one who thought that they had ever got a tax cut from Paul Martin or from Jean Chrétien. This, I firmly believe then and still believe today, was that the tax cuts had largely fallen off the public radar by November of 2005. There was, in short, a tremendous public cynicism about tax cuts. It was impossible for us to get over that wall of cynicism by talking about tax cuts the way that politicians had talked about tax cuts for a decade, or the way that the economists or the people who claim to know economists wanted us to talk about it. We needed a way to reinvigorate the tax-cutting agenda in Canadian politics with a simple, clear bail proposition to Canadian voters, 7-6-5 fit the bill. It was something that Canadians would see every day and that they would be able to hold us to account for if we did not deliver. Despite economic evidence to the contrary, in my view, the GST commitment worked. It worked in the sense that by the 2005-2006 campaign, voters identified the Conservative Party as a party of lower taxes, and overwhelmingly so. It worked in the sense that it helped us win. Not an issue for public policy people to think about, I don't think. It worked in the sense that delivering on the promise that the government elected last year, despite breaking another tax-related promise on income trusts. Moreover, it gave us the political advantage to extend our tax-cutting agenda further, with a five-year plan announced in the fall of 2005 to cut corporate taxes from federal corporate taxes from 22% to 15% over 5 years, and to begin reducing personal income taxes by increasing some of the brackets announced in January's budget by Mr. Flaherty. We never did keep the promise, the corollary promise, set up a special GST vote would allow economists and their friends to keep paying 7% if they wished. And although I was out of politics for last fall election, I still enjoyed watching the campaign from the sideline as the Liberals ran a campaign based on increasing consumption taxes, so they cut corporate and personal income taxes, using the argument made by economists and their friends that this made a lot of sense and would help Canada be more productive, more innovative, and more green. The more green is probably an argument we would never have made. By the end of the campaign, the public opinion was even stronger than it had been at the end of the 2006 campaign, that the Conservative Party was hardy of lower taxes, and the party will continue to lower taxes.
Thank you.
Wendy.
I'm a short person, so I'm going to stand up. Right, thank you. Do that one. Good. I'm going to speak on something completely different. I'm just that much longer out of government, so probably with a slightly different perspective, that hindsight perspective, which, as I've already commented on, it gives you a rather sharper view sometimes than you have in the middle of the crisis. What I'm going to speak about is the foot-and-mouth epidemic that may have been known, or technically at Zurich in the UK in 2001. Evidence was key and science was key, and so I've summarized it about speaking science to politics. This crisis was going on really just as I was going to Downing Street, and not being in any way an expert on such matters, I assure you, that's probably in one of those categories that Ian just described, but nevertheless, it was a compelling story, and I think an interesting perspective on the importance of evidence and how organized really in government. For those of you who weren't in the UK, weren't close to farming industries, which I think might be quite a lot of people in this room, these are some of the headlines. This epidemic was one of the largest in history in the world, certainly in Europe. There were over 2,000 animals infected, we thought, perhaps. There was about 6 to 10 million cows and sheep killed in the course of this epidemic. Again, you can see the numbers themselves were pretty challenging to put a finger on. It reckons to have cost UK about $60 dollars translated, £8 million, and it completely dominated the UK media from its beginning to its end in the run-up to the general, the second election that the Labour government was to face. So that was pretty key. Some chronology of events. I won't go through this in detail, but characterized the crisis. Very quick chain of events that were demanding of government very quick responses. Very characteristic, really, kind of scenarios that Evan was speaking about earlier. You know, the first case was reported in February. Within 2 days, the European Union had imposed a worldwide ban on all British livestock exports. By early March, there were cases being reported across the country. MAF, which was then the Ministry of Agricultural Food and Farming, doesn't exist any longer, but at the time, applied its contingency plan, and basically the policy, as had been established many years, was culling confirmed cases. Complete confusion across government and its communications about whether the epidemic was under control or not. Contradictory statements being made every day, and within about 3 weeks of the first case. By the 23rd of March, the Prime Minister takes control of the whole operation, which is pretty, if any of you know the Westminster model, this is on. And in a very symbolic place is the Cobra Room, is the Cabinet Office control room. It's, you know, got pictures of Churchill in it. So this was a very powerful PR move and a very controversial one. Policy moved then into killing on suspicion and what was called the 3-kilometer rule, animals killed within that ring. Finally, the case, last case was reported in September. Subsequent 4 commissions of inquiry undertaken by government and the part responsible abolished. So lots of sources of experience about how science was playing into this. And some of the headlines that were constantly reported in the inquiries, evidence that was conducted over a series of months, was this powerful headline that science appears to have let it down. It wasn't the only one. There were a lot of other players, believe me, but this one was some of the most resounding. And I'm just going to touch a little bit about some of the key 3 bits of evidence that you would have thought would have been able to support in a policy-making situation like this. You know, how do you diagnose this thing? How do you forecast it? And what do you do about it? This is going to be, you know, the Daily Mail version of these questions. There's a much more complex one, and I refer you to the Royal Society inquiry into the science underpinning this episode. But I'll give you ones that we could understand, those of us who weren't on that side of the business in Downing Street. First off, there's this classic tension that I think, again, has been referred to by Evan in the need for speed versus the desire for certainty. And science often wants certainty, and politics wants speed. And I think sometimes there's a tension. The big problem here was that the lab that was only one lab left really by this point in the UK after quite a long period of public expenditure cuts was one lab. It's taking up to 4 days to diagnose the cases. There was rapid on-farm tests available to tell, you know, whether the animal had the disease or not, but they hadn't invalidated. In a global world, the US Agricultural Research Service had absolute confidence in the sort of on-farm testing approaches, but they're prepared to enter into a validation process because they had published their results. We recognize some of these tensions within the academic world. The epidemic seemed to be continuing, the delays in the culling and disposal practice creating more pressures and political demands, a group is convened to try and put together some modeling. And again, we've heard some examples of this about computer modeling and such challenges. And this particular model was put together by a sort of group of freelancers, basically, current people across the country wanting to become engaged. The chair of the Food Safety Commission, a reasonable position to take up this issue, put together some group of epidemiologists and people who knew epidemiologists, to use that phrase, and perhaps unfairly, and a group was put together. Unfortunately, you know, they drew up this policy about how, using data from MAF, about how this disease is going to spread and how quickly, and then what kind of culling process you need to introduce, the speed of it and the circumference around it. It led eventually to a very controversial policy, which was later proven also to be unlawful, which was that you would cull all animals on suspicion of infection in a 3-kilometer circle of the original kind of a source of infection. And every scientist who knew anything about this, or didn't, was giving media interviews all the time. And some of the most damning criticisms have been made about the different scientists' roles in it. But I guess the modelling issue is always one that we can point to with some systematic importance, is that if you put data in that is not got any validity, it produces garbage out. So that isn't much a problem of the modeling. It was very important at the moment. The third question, yes, was to vaccinate or not. Again, I'm going to get into this in any detail here, but the main thing is this was a strategy that had been successfully in other parts of Europe, different ways of doing it, vaccinate on a big scale or a smaller scale. But the big question was, became political. And there's evidence that this could be introduced. It had been introduced in some places. It was really very much a ministerial preference. But the department, very much backed by the farmers, were really concerned about this status, a disease-free status without vaccination, a trade status, which they didn't want to let go. So three pieces of science that couldn't really give a definitive view, very competing, confusing messages into the public sphere. And finally, in terms of the economics, the reality was that although all the decisions, supported by a very strong dream of the scientific community, were about protecting Britain's disease-free status without vaccination, actually the greatest losses resulted from the closure of the footpaths. You know, the economic impact overall of this disease, the PR impact of, you know, the empires of animals was shown, interestingly. The biggest impact is a loss of about $5.4 billion in the leisure industry, far greater than about the $500 million that was lost in the agricultural and food industry. So, you know, evidence was present, it was competing, it was conflicting, but ultimately the politics become quite important. And I guess just to lighten it up, but something that I do know, some of the evidence that really had the most powerful impact wasn't anything really, not the models, not the various views about diagnosis or vaccination. It was things like this. We like animals. Animals have a personality. You forget the human dimension. And when the Colin got close to Babe, there was really no view left in the public mind about what had to stop. I don't know what the relationship was to Babe, but anyway, there was something that was being approached. And then ultimately, 11-year-old boy's pet calf called Phoenix. The population was so mobilized around these individual stories of animals that people love. And it just wasn't going to tolerate any more of the culling strategy. Out of control or not, you know, it became something that finally the logistics of the culling managed to catch up. But it was media campaigns on these particular animals that probably had the most compelling. So I think I've done my time, but there was just tons of inquiries into these things. That was one of them. Another one on the future of the farming industry. Another one that was done by the Royal Society. And I can tell you, one of the advantages of retrospect is that it really do learn quite a lot about what you ought to have done afterwards. And some of the more perhaps lasting lessons, which I think are perhaps relevant to other governments, is how you actually organize science within government. Maybe this is a minority interest amongst those of us who like to run governments or hope they will work. Is that there were things that could be done that are things that have now been introduced in the UK, things like the government's chief scientific officer, who I think, as Mel Cat said yesterday, explains science to the Prime Minister, and the Prime Minister needs to understand. 4 weeks before a general election, if this is happening, he needs to understand. Each department has a chief scientific advisor, there's a prime ministerial committee, there's actually guidance on how you acquire and maintain top-level scientific advice in government, and there's a program of reviews, public reviews, some of which I showed you there, but how to, of each department's scientific capacity, assessed on its quality and use of sciences in the department, and those are made public, and they're independent. So I think, there is lessons to be learned, and something we can do better recognizing the complexity of some of these issues. But nevertheless, there was another foot-and-mouth disease outbreak in 2007. But the good news, I think, was that it was managed in a much more efficient way logistically, which was important, but also scientifically. The laws, regulations had been changed. Diagnosis was done locally. Vaccination was introduced by law and made possible, and it did make a difference. Here we are.
Matthew Wilson, the talks, say something about regionalism and...
Thank you very much. It is a great honor to be here, and this is the first time I've been able to participate in a panel since I left government, so I'm very happy to be here. I would point out, though, Christopher, that I'm even more distinguished than your introduction suggests, because I, too, was a student at McGill. Ian and I were undergrads here, that will explain to some extent the ambition of both of our talks. I'd like to talk the nature of Canada and the relationship between public servants and politicians and the nature of politics in this country. And both Ian and I have learned ambition at McGill a couple of decades ago. So it's a great pleasure to be here on this panel with such distinguished guests. What I'd like to talk about is the challenge of using evidence on high-profile issues that are regionally divisive. Obviously, in Canada, we have very different regional narratives and regional political cultures in this country, and then high-profile issues emerge that require evidence. Sometimes these come into conflict with deeply embedded but often incorrect regionally based narratives and political culture. What I'd like to talk about specifically is the issue of equalization and decisions made on equalization over the last 5 years. Equalization, as we know, is the principle of equalization is constitutionally mandated, and the federal government is committed to the principle that all provincial governments should have adequate resources to provide reasonable levels of public services, reasonably comparable levels of public services at reasonably comparable levels of taxation. Now, there are some people who may claim they understand equalization or have friends who say they understand equalization, but that is close to null set, as a matter of fact, very few people understand. So when issues of equalization, debates around it come up, this obviously comes to conflict with the fact that people don't understand it, and so it is very easy to fall back upon regional political narratives. Equalization is an expression of our, in my opinion, noblest aspirations, our sense of shared citizenship, our commitment to one another to ensure equality of opportunity across the country. So the program and its principles represent, from my perspective, reflections of our noblest aspirations and shared citizenship. But equalization, since its inception, has been a program that allocated $267 billion and has been a redistribution of wealth of about $114 billion from the province of Ontario to other provinces in Canada. And the interesting issue is that we have never asked the question whether the program is achieving its constitutional aims. We've never addressed the question. Not one bit of evidence has been brought to bear on the question of whether this enormous transfer of wealth and what has been over its life a $267 billion program is coming close to achieving the constitutional principle to which it's supposed to meet, which is ensuring reasonably comparable levels of public services, reasonably comparable levels of taxation across the country. There have obviously been a large number of studies and debates, but we have never asked the fundamental question from the offshore accords, from the new framework in 2004 that Paul Martin introduced, from the 2007 changes based on the Orion report that the Harper government introduced, and then more recently the 2009 changes to equalization. None of these have ever been driven by a discussion of whether or not the program as designed was large enough and was meeting its constitutional obligations. So the question is why? Because this evidence could be available. We could certainly assess whether Canadians in all provinces had reasonably comparable levels of public services at reasonably comparable levels of taxation. And the answer from my perspective is that we don't want to know. Large number of provincial governments don't want to know, and the federal government doesn't want to know. And the federal government doesn't want to know, and I'm not being critical or it's not a malicious reason, but if we knew the answer, this may require significant fundamental changes to a foundational program that would call up a variety of quite intense regional tensions and divisions and may come into conflict with deeply held, deeply embedded conventional wisdoms in various regions. As Evan Lynch talked about this morning, we're obviously much more focused on problems of a global nature, and so examining whether or not this program is meeting its ends may produce for us domestically created political conflict or tension at a time when we are much more preoccupied with larger issues. So what I would like to talk about is why we have never assessed this program. I think on its face, it's pretty clear that the program isn't meeting its obligations. It's clear that Alberta can provide public services at lower levels of taxation. I mean, we know that. And my hunch is most provinces that receive equalization can provide higher quality public services, lower level taxation than Ontario and British Columbia, but I don't have evidence for that. That's my suspicion. That evidence would be available if we chose to accumulate it. But the question is why we haven't chosen. And I have quite quickly in my 3 or 4 minutes left would like to share five reasons with you. The first, as I've described, is deeply embedded regional political cultures that have conventional wisdoms about who is favored and who is disfavored in the country, who is advantaged, who is disadvantaged. I don't have to elaborate on that. And the federal government has an obligation to manage those tensions and conflicts and competing regional narratives. Secondly, for people who do public policy, is the concept of path dependency. Early policy choices create situations in which later choices are heavily constrained and must follow a particular kind of path. In Canada, the choice to create an equalization program, I would say employment insurance, has dramatically constrained our ability to make fundamental changes to these foundational programs. These foundational programs are expressions of a shared citizenship, are expressions of our obligation to one another, and from my perspective, no longer work and are not meeting their intended objectives. But because of choices made in the 1950s and 60s, when coupled with regional political narratives, it becomes very difficult to change these without calling up intense regional tension and significant regional opposition in various provinces. Third, I would say political parties have very little incentive to bring evidence to bear on high-profile commitments. Obviously, there is a lot of evidence used in government decision-making and policy-making, but on high-profile policy commitments, governments, the elected government, have very little incentive, generalized incentive, to bring evidence to bear on the commitments that they have made or on the commitments and programs of their predecessors. Evidence may come to the conclusion that commitments shouldn't be fulfilled, or that previous government programs are working well. New governments don't necessarily have an incentive to bring that evidence to bear on those kinds of decisions. Fourth, I would say we have an adversarial federal provincial political culture in this country which creates secretive decision-making. For example, it may be surprising to people in this room, but provincial governments don't have access to the calculations on equalization that the federal government undertakes. And so again, an enormous transfer of wealth, a program of $267 billion over its life, and provinces, if they tried to replicate the numbers that the federal government uses, would be unable to do so. We kind of get close, but we have a secretive political culture and adversarial federal-provincial dynamic which creates a desire to hoard particular evidence and not share that evidence, and that makes it very difficult to bring evidence to bear on political decision-making. We are obviously in a world, in an open-source world, where more and more people have more and more evidence, but on many of our most intense federal-provincial discussions, there isn't a sharing of evidence which will allow for informed decision-making. And finally, I would say, to pick up on Kevin Lynch's comment from this morning where the plural of anecdote is not knowledge, I would point out that death is a tragedy, but 1,000 is a statistic, and we very much are in a time and period where we are much more focused on the strategic management of short-term issues and managing the stories and the tragedies rather than dealing with the evidence. I think the extended period of minority government has not served us well in that respect, which has made us more focused on strategic management of issues over the short term, and whether that's a particular anecdote or a story or tragedy, rather than the focus on the statistic and the evidence. And by the way, by way of parenthesis, I think that's inherent in minority governments. I think that interacts with our political culture, where we are not accustomed to minority government and don't know how to govern well in periods of minority government for the long term. So those are my comments. I mean to be particularly pessimistic. Equalization is obviously an extreme example, and there are many issues where evidence does come to bear on public policy making. But in this particular instance, I think that the evidence interacts with conventional wisdom in various regions and is much safer and easier to replicate the conventional wisdom. And I do believe that we need to find better ways of bringing evidence to bear on very challenging public policy issues such as the allocation of wealth in the country. Thank you.
Thanks, Chris. I can't resist a podium, so I'm standing up here. I want to make a quick case. I'm delighted to be here. Je suis beaucoup le fait que Antonia et les autres ont changé leur communauté. I want to make a quick case of the importance in order of public policy, parliament and legitimacy, and politics. Public policy is more important in Canada than in most countries, because Canada has always been an act of will. We didn't come together naturally. We don't stay together. Confederation was an act of will. So we're Medicare, equalization, the Charter of Rights, free trade. Just parenthetically, I say that I know a lot of instances where conventional wisdom, including regional conventional wisdom, has been confronted. It was the case in the Charter. It was the case in free trade. It was the case in the initial introduction of equalization. So these are not fatally inhibiting factors. But the point I want to make is to underline the reality that in our country, we have to keep proving our worth to our parts. Now, what has moved Canadians forward, I would argue, together, has been political will expressed by the authority of Parliament. We all know that in practice it is government which actually acts, but it is on the authority of Parliament, not in reality the Queen, but Parliament, the national institution which, as a human matter, reaches literally into every corner of the land through the living, breathing people who are elected as members of Parliament. Now, here's the problem. In an age when the legitimacy of institutions is under constant stress, we live with a theory of the Westminster parliamentary system which we adopted almost reflexively and which may not fit the country. In that theory, the essential power of a member of Parliament is not to govern, but rather to hold the government to account. Certainly, an important part of the function of an MP is to hold those in power to account. But I was elected 8 times as a member of Parliament. In none of those elections did I assume that I would leave all the governing to others. In none of them did the people who voted me assume that my principal purpose would be to hold others to account. I ran for office to be part of the initiative, not part of the control. That's what my constituents expected. That's what they voted for, because I was acting in their name. That is what most members of Parliament expect and what their constituents expect. But that is not how the system is structured. It is not, with great respect to the Privy Council, past and present in this room, and the tradition they represent, it is not a public service expects. Or, in most cases, it is not what a party leader expects. So the major disconnect between the actual passive Parliament, which is not much involved in the initiation of policy, and the expectation of our citizens, for whom their Parliament, not their government, not their public service, only occasionally their political parties, but their Parliament, is the connection to the government of their country. Evan Lynch made the observation today that it is elected officials who make policy decisions. Well, that is not as true as the phrase would suggest. They sign the paper, but it is a much more complex question as to who makes the decision. If we want to return the legitimacy and authority to retain the legitimacy and authority of Parliament, the institution which lets us act our will, any serious discussion of policy formation has to anticipate a much larger role for Parliament in actual decision-making. Now, let's talk about politics. The late Mr. Speaker Tip O'Neill said famously, all politics is local. I've never been sure of the grammar of that phrase, but he was from Boston. That is not just a description of a particular time and place. That is true of modern Ghana and Gdansk and Gujarat and most places where governments exist which we describe as democratic. It's another way of asserting a fairly fundamental democratic view that policies will shape a community need some support in that community. As a practical matter, it is also what makes policy decisions legitimate and effective, and thus not just right. Yet the evidence that Tip O'Neill would weigh in Boston would not be the research-based evidence which this conference is considering. That kind of hard, research-driven evidence would often be part of the mix of decision-making, but it would usually be balanced by what one could describe with scientific precision as instinct. At an earlier conference this Monday at McGill, the inauguration of the new McGill Institute on the Study of International Development, the Indian scholar Pratap Mehta argued that what really makes governance work in the unruly democracy of India has been precisely the political instincts of politicians, often very local politicians. Now, assuming that is true, which I do, we need to consider whether the growing recourse to hard evidence and other developments is actually squeezing out the instinct in political decisions, causing the politicians to become less political, and thus the system to become less responsive and less legitimate. In the case of cabinet ministers in Canada's federal parliamentary system, they are overloaded by workload, by travel, by lobbyists, by constituency and other pressures, and overloaded by information, whether it is evidence-based or simply the stuff that's pumped to us all by Nick Nanos. There is little time for a minister to reflect or to speak consequentially with his or her political colleagues. And as critically, there is little time to maintain close or direct contact with the people who helped someone get elected and who are often your best critics and your best connectors with reality. When I became active in Canadian politics, that was 1957, 1958, the small staff of senior ministers of the then government included prominently people, and they weren't all men, interestingly, with long and intimate experience in the human dynamics of, to take a random example, the multicultural farm community around Prince Albert, Saskatchewan. Or, thinking of the Lady Goodman, the dynamics of the city of Toronto, or of Trois-Rivières, or Kamloops, or Cape Breton. And when the Mulroney government was on our way to losing the 1983 election, a much higher proportion of our advisors were certified experts who were schooled in polling, or in management, or in communications, or occasionally in evidence-based research. But they were a long move from what was actually going on in local communities. It's important to note that what Speaker O'Neill and Dr. Mehta were describing is not simply and literally local knowledge. It is social knowledge, how people react and interact. And eccentric as and intangible as that can be, it is critically what communities rely on when the bridge collapses, when the financial system collapses, when the rules stop working, when the careful assumptions are proven to be wrong. On a more everyday level, that is what the community relies on when an established rule doesn't quite fit a real-life case, or the culture or the demographics change, or an established practice becomes outdated. That is when the ultimate policy deciders, in our theory, the politicians, have to rise above their benighted blackberries and their experts. And I argue, I worry, that we are squeezing that capacity out of policymaking, out of a policymaking system in which it is essential. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sean. Thank you to all of our panelists. The floor is now open for questions. To our students, Patrick and I are going to be wandering the room with wireless microphones. You heard Antonia's order. You are not to touch microphones, but they're happy to take your to take questions. So the floor is open. We'd like to start with students, so if there are any who want to, so, but if not, please. Someone back there? Not allowed to microphone, huh? Tony will fire
me. I'd like to thank the panelists. Especially, I'd like to thank Yarudi for his candor. I think what he described about the GST cut is in my view a good example of how ideology trumps evidence in the making of policy, which leads me to my question. In social life, facts do not speak by themselves. So here this morning we talk about evidence-based policy, but we also need to talk about value-based policy. And I think that Minister Clark was referring to that. So, because values are the filter that give meaning to empirical evidence. So I'd like to hear what the panelists have to say about what they think is a proper balance or relationship between values and evidence in policy development. Thank you.
You want to jump on that first? All of the panels actually touched on that to some degree. Ian, do you want to...
Maybe I might take this from my disciplinary perspective in political science. I mean, I think it's a different way of saying that politics in a democratic system of government is partisan. It's not nonpartisan. There is a nonpartisan role in a system of government, of course, as Kevin outlined this morning. And those of us who worked on the partisan side, those of us who work on the partisan side, have to keep that in mind and with great respect and deference to the folks who work on the nonpartisan side. But at the political level, the democratic system, it's a partisan system. Parties can organize themselves in lots of different ways. Parties can organize themselves on regional grounds, on ethnic grounds, on, I think you probably call, ideological grounds. But there are no nonpartisan parties, at least in a mere democratic system. In a mere democratic system, politics is partisan. And does that link us to a sort of a competing groups of social knowledge? That's part of the art of party making and party building. And the upside of that is the system does, over time, put a huge incentive on opposition parties to organize the out groups that are temporarily groups or should be temporarily out of groups, in an effort to create a coalition that will become the in-coalition for its period of time. And then the previous governing party goes over to the opposition benches and tries to renew itself in the same way. And I was very privileged with the experience of a lifetime to help in that process. I should have a comfort about that.
Any other comments?
Well, I think the optimum relationship between, you know, values and evidence that I think we should be seeking is, you know, is perhaps what we've all hinted at here, is it's good to have the evidence as a piece of the overall decision-making process, but it's not sufficient. You know, it's certainly exactly why I was giving the local understanding, the human relationship to the subject under consideration. Those were very, very powerful sources of values. That was what was driving as much as science. But, you know, maybe I'm old-fashioned irrational. You know, the hope, I think, is that there is some evidence on which, you know, there can be agreement, and from which then the values can play in a more transparent way. Then can make, I think, in better informed choices. And this may be, I think evidence is absurd or claims are made that are known to untrue. I don't think that's in some democratic process.
I'm just going to astound everybody who come to the defense briefly of Ian Brody, briefly. Because it's important to remember that the case he made, in part, with the GST, was that there had been a campaign promise to do it. In a system where we worry about legitimacy, political parties have to take seriously in their office what they proposed on the way to office. It does raise questions as to what evidence should be considered in putting together campaign platforms, but that is, as Ian has just said, necessarily from a narrower evidence base than the whole country. And if you talk about values, in one sense, one definition of values, one application of values, would be to retain the value of legitimacy in a political system. Keeping your promises helps do that, and breaking your promises helps break that.
Question here.
My name is Mel Kapp. I'm an economist. I claim to know economist, and I'm proud of it. I just want to come in on those points, and I want to credit Ian, as he was, with the defense of the GST cuts, which was not evidence-based policy. Neither was policy-based evidence. I mean, you didn't say, we were going to do this, and here's why, and then provide what Wendy characterized as, I forget what the term, unsubstantiated claims. Thank you. Though I guess the point is, how do we get back to letting the evidence enter the debate? And last night I said I thought it was perfectly legitimate that people met their campaign promises and that ministers rejected the evidence on the basis of political expediency. I think political is a positive thing, not a negative thing. But having said that, we should be able to have an informed debate. So officials, I would argue, should be the conscience of the cabinet, that they can't make unsubstantiated claims.
No, look, I mean, my purpose in the presentation I made earlier, maybe I should have been less subtle. I'm partly a defense of the GSE promise, sure, for sure. But what allowed was a turning of the tables in the debate about tax policy and levels of taxes in Canada that didn't end with cutting the GST from 5%. Of course, Kevin and officials provided ample advice about the fiscal mix and budget options and so on and so forth. I won't say what they said because it's not, you know, those are the rules of the game. They get the cover of secrecy in order to be frank with their with the political level, and that's how, I mean, rest assured, they were explicit, vigorous, rigorous, all the right phrases. The GST had then let us have a bigger debate about other tax policy issues, and I don't think that you could have had the fall 2007 corporate tax cut plan without the GST cut first. And corporate tax cut plans, every bit as big as GST in dollar value, is a massively expensive multi-year effort, which was accelerated in the last budget. It came just as the credit crunch was beginning. To be blunt, it was a plan we'd probably intend to unveil in the spring 2008 budget, but because of the beginnings of the credit crunch and aspect of the problem in Canada, accelerated. But it was the integration and the table turning of that bit, I would say.
Additional questions? What about here? And then we'll move up here.
Hi, my name is Angela Nidus, and I'm a proud member of your Canadian Public Service. I find that partisan paradigm you keep talking about, it is really, as a public servant, yes, I give advice, yes, I depend on the politicians to make their decision because it's the public will. But what is becoming more of a growing concern is how much discourse we have in the public and how much the public is engaged in the running of the country and as determined by voter turnout. So if we're going to make decisions based on partisan policies, it'd be a bit more reassuring if we had a higher voter turnout and people were engaged, or there was a discourse across the country on issues. As was mentioned yesterday with the criminal justice issue, you don't get a full play of the issues in the public or response, and you wonder, are decisions being made on a lack of understanding on the part of public or a lack of awareness on the part of politicians about what the public wants? I just wonder, do you have any comments on how partisanship plays in decision-making when we have lower voter turnout and lower public engagement in public policy?
Joe, that's really a question about the ordinary MP to do the helpful.
It just stands to reason. If you elect able, connected people to Parliament and you give them no capacity to influence policy, they're going to act in a partisan way. And I understand that what I suggested a few moments ago is a radical change in the way we look at how our system works. But before we run around developing a whole bunch of new consultative processes, and Lord knows I've been through them, I was the author, I regret to say, a space mission some years ago. Before we create all these new fangled agencies that work and work, why don't we go back to the institution we have, which has the advantages of being connected everywhere, at least coming from everywhere, and has a real legitimacy in our system, the Parliament, and try to find some way in which it can become more engaged in substantive things and thus less divided on partisan lines. And I think everybody who's worked with parliaments and really tried to make them work has found that when people become locked into an issue, the partisanship tends to slip aside on some of those questions. Other matters become more important. I think the question of the decline in voting is very serious, particularly since so many of the people who aren't voting are young. And that means that we're not just losing voters, we're losing a tradition of voting. And I think that raises very real questions of critical importance to a country like this, in which our political activity is really, literally, one of our very few national activities. And so if we are weakening those instruments, we're weakening a great deal. And I think there has to be some serious talk, perhaps at some future conference here, on what one does to deal with to return some actual influence on policy, on the people who come from, and every 4 years, now more often, have to go back to constituents to get re-elected or elected.
I think the Parliament issue is very important, and the voting question, I concur, is very important. But I also think that there is a role for leadership, really, in some of these issues of evidence that are unpalatable or run against political cultures, and that, you know, that takes a kind of courage, that takes a way of standing up and saying we can't go on like this. And I think that when the public already knows that's true, you know, they would actually need some resonance back. And I think it's a brave politician who does that, and sometimes, I think we could see a little more of it in some of our politicians. I think it would overcome some of the, you know, party, more minutiae party politics. But again, you can sense my naive optimism even after 30 years in government. You know, there we are.
There was a hand there.
Thank you. I want to get back to, I guess, the tension that we heard between what Mr. Clark marked at the end of the address regarding the less legitimacy or accountability in relation to citizens, and the tension that Mr. Lynch brought up at the beginning of the morning around this idea that issue and policy challenges are now much more complex and global than they were before. So the challenges are global and far removed from individual citizens, and the science or the evidence behind them is inherently complex. How do we then engage citizens who may not have the time, resources, or knowledge necessary to participate in an informed debate? Is our media, parties, or other institutions failing us in acting as interpreters for citizens of those issues?
Anyone want to grab that one?
Well, I think the public can be given more credit, and we sometimes give them. You know, I think issues that I was pointing out just by way of example, you know, obviously the science was complex, but you know, the competing views within science was as much to do with the politics of the science community as it was to do with the evidence itself, which, you know, came perhaps, you know, we recognize and don't always speak about. So once you actually pin down some complex issues, they have to be able to be understood well enough to be communicated and engaged in, and I don't think we all give the public as much credit as we should on that.
I do think we acquiesce to conventional wisdoms too frequently, and I do think we are. We've been going through a period over the last decade, and will probably continue for maybe another decade, as we try and figure out how to accommodate better quality public discourse with the changes in communication technology and new media and social media and connections between citizens, not just in communities but around the world, and the access to information and knowledge, not just facts, information, but knowledge that people have, and the sense of empowerment and engagement that people have when they are making private sector purchases, when they are participating in nonprofit sectors or engaging their communities, and the difficulty that they have translating that interest, engagement, sometimes knowledge, into traditional politics. And again, that's not being, I don't mean to be critical. We have been experiencing a remarkable cultural change and a remarkable technological change over the last decade. And governments, by their nature, are conservative and should be conservative. And I don't mean that in a partisan sense. I mean that they are the institution that, you know, shouldn't say, you know, let's try a new ad here that could have enormous consequences. Companies can go bankrupt, nonprofit sector, organizations can fail. Governments have enormous responsibilities to be cautious. And I tend, personally and politically, to support various innovation, governments, particularly the public service, has an enormous responsibility. So not being critical, but I do concur that, and I echo Wendy's comment, that the public generally increasingly capable of engaging with evidence-based decisions and having serious substantive discussions about challenging issues and being presented with those facts and options and moving forward. But we haven't yet figured out what process or what technology or what institution will allow that to happen, and I think that's a conversation we continue to have over the next decade.
Yeah, great. You know, citizens aren't dumb. And in fact, citizens are less dumb as a group than they were 25, 30 years ago because they're better educated. They've had a sense of efficacy. They're more. It's not just formal education. They know more. They do act often to leadership, not always, but they do act to, and they understand more. Jim Flaherty's observation last night about the value he found in sitting silent in meeting people talk about what they thought should be done. That speaks a lot. If we had systems that were more able to listen directly. The intermediary issue is a complex one, but the assumption has to be that the state of knowledge and potential engagement of citizens is an asset in this process, not an obstacle.
Professor Reagan, and then we'll come up to you. Right in the back, Emma, and then
My name is Chris Ray. I'm a professor of economics here, and for the next 18 months, I'm lucky enough to be at the Department of Finance in Ottawa. And I wanted to come back to GST, actually, as a way to motivate my question. I was one of those economists, and I still am one of those economists, who think cutting the GST was a very bad idea. But it's because, as an economist, and my fellow economists, I think about the design of the tax system, we think of what is an efficient way to raise money, et cetera, et cetera. But a bunch of things that we tend not to think about. When Mel Capp, in his question, suggested that the decision to reduce the GST was not an evidence-based decision, I think he was using evidence-based too narrowly, and I think there's a danger here in using this term too narrowly. It was, in my view, absolutely evidence-based decision. There was this other piece of evidence the government of the day looked at, and that evidence was, it was then and still remains, the most hated tax probably in Canadian history. And that's a very important piece of evidence when you happen to be running in an election. Okay? It's not a piece of evidence that the economists thinking about any of the tax system think about. So when Mel posed the question, you know, when will evidence-based policy decisions become popular, I'd like to pose the question slightly differently. When will we see the time when governments are less swayed by what is often short-term political considerations and more swayed by what one could argue is good for the country in a broader sense. And looking back in time, one can think of the beginning of deficit reduction in the early, in mid-1990s, the introduction of the GST itself in 1991, the reduction of inflation and the adoption of inflation targets in 1991, the adoption of free trade in 1988, all of those as being things that were terribly controversial at the time, very unpopular for large fractions of the Canadian population, yet we had governments at the time who were taking the long view. So my question is, why am I wrong in thinking that Canadian governments are less taking the long view these days? And if I'm correct that they are less taking a long view, when do we start to see them taking a longer view? Thank you.
Matthew.
Serious times require serious people and serious decisions, and I think the question of the GST and the conventional wisdom here that we've just talked about in terms of evidence from public opinion, the most hated tax versus evidence from economists, is actually we have a counterpoint right now. The Ontario government yesterday announced that with the agreement of the federal government and with support from the federal government, will be harmonizing its provincial sales tax with the GST. The Ontario government has resisted this for years because of the very reasons that people have talked about in terms of it being the most hated tax, it being visible, it applying to a variety of consumer goods. And business community and economists have been presenting evidence, economic evidence, for years, encouraging the government to change that decision and harmonize. So the government's made that decision, and I would say that that decision was in part informed by helpful negotiations agreement with the federal government, but I would say by a particular recognition of a serious economic storm and a serious need for economic transformation in the provincial economy. And so I do think that periods like this, one could end up being more responsive to short-term public opinion, but I also am hopeful that it is a time when people become a little bit more serious, a little more focused, and do think about evidence more seriously and long-term prosperity, long-term benefits of the policy choices they're making.
Well, let's hope so. But I guess some of the characteristics of kind of long-term thinking, I think, is getting to a place where things can't go on like this, because there's a series, a conjuncture of some pressures. We just have to stand up and say, in a true spirit of leadership, no, this can't go on. Maybe you don't really know what to do, but you know you can't go on. And I didn't hear that yesterday or today coming from some of the Canadian leaders that I was listening to here. I was hearing how well we're doing, how much better we're doing than everybody else, and how much that's because we're so prudent and boring. Those are not characteristics. proud of, as we may, well, that they may be suing us at the moment, those may not characteristics where you can expect a radically visionary, strategic-driven government. But, you know, I've been away a long time, and maybe I'm not supposed to say things like that. But it just struck me that those would be my observations. They don't sound to me like the leaders I was hearing in Europe when I was there this week, or we're here to the south.
It's an interesting crisis. You know, Sarkozy is now back in the command structure of NATO. The British government and other European governments are taking a very active role in financial institutions. The whole Obama approach is based upon he can undertake transformational change in the U.S. because he knows there is a sense of crisis. Will that work? It's too early to judge. Well, again, he's not dumb. They've sat down and thought about this. And I think now the other question that's raised has to do with, in a Canadian context, has to do with whether minority governments work. I'm not well-placed to comment on that comment. But it's worth noting, just in terms of our normal notes like this, that one of those successful governments, including in terms of initiating enduring initiatives, was the minority government of Mr. Pearson. So there is no fatal characteristic to minority governments. And we may just have to, that may be another reality to which we have to adjust in the country. But we shouldn't despair. It looks like there's going to be a series of minorities.
To Chris. I think it will happen, and has happened past, when we get past the difficult job of generating evidence into, I have found from having done both jobs, the much more difficult job of constructing political agendas. Kemp spoke this morning about the long investment of resources in not only understanding where over-reliance on deficit spending was going to get us collectively in the 1970s and the 1980s and the 1990s, but also tremendous and much more difficult effort of trying to get that economic knowledge out into the public arena more pointedly, more systematically, and more accessibly to a broader range of people. If this were just a matter of sort of simple work by relatively smart people, standing on with one last election campaign, hands down, he had the argument, after all, that the Green Shift was all the things that economists kept claiming that he had, knew all sorts of economists who thought it was a great idea. I didn't see any of them claiming they were. The Martin government and the Martin years when he was at finance were all about productivity, innovation, competitiveness, all this other stuff. I have no idea what any of those words mean. I never met anybody going door-to-door and understood what any of those words meant. There would be an R party who could put their finger on what any of that was about. And in the end, I think the 2004 and then the 2005-06 campaign was the evidence that the Martin government and all sorts of other people connected to the market were just talking past most voters. And I think there's a, you know, nobody had any deficit. Yeah. Over a very long period of time, people understood what that's all about. Product of the innovation, competitiveness, who the hell knows what any of that is. I think this goes back to the question, is this an engagement and voter turnout? We tried to solve this, start to solve this problem in 2006 by devising campaign issues that were intended to bring long-time non-voters back into the voter population. That is an extremely, well, that was the hardest part of the job, was to pull, we had set the objective of trying to raise turnout rate by 2 percentage points and to bring those people disproportionately into the conservative side. That was the hardest part of the job and remains the hardest part of the job, and once we're government, as the last campaign showed, we couldn't sustain it.
So I have a question about the discussion of evidence in policymaking, which is the topic of this panel. I've been finding a lot of comments today, particularly in the presentations last night, that when evidence is referenced at part of the process of policymaking, that at least I've been finding, they're almost relating evidence being synonymous with truth, and that evidence therefore means that it's true what is being proposed in the evidence. But at least whenever I've researched difficult topics in papers, I've always found that evidence isn't so clear-cut, and often there's a lot of competing evidence related to all claims. So like when this panel is called Does Evidence Matter? In policymaking, I've gotten the impression throughout that evidence is too optimistic from the presentations, that we're believing that politicians and government are only are disregarding the truth if they're disregarding evidence. And at least I would say that evidence is complex and there's competing evidence. So I was asking what role from both with government and both from and outside of government does competing evidence play in the policy process and in relation to the discussion.
Any responses to that?
Well, I mean, your points are valid. I think the wider sense of evidence is an important one. I think that most of us are pointing to that isn't just about the computer model. In fact, I think most of us were saying it isn't the computer model. You know, but there are subjectivities, you know, that need to be local knowledge. You know, these are the wider sense of evidence. And, you know, I mean, I did work for a party that won times in a row. So I know that political evidence does play a part in determining decision-making. I prefer to be fully transparent. But, you know, that's a matter of taste. So I think, you know, I think we're saying evidence, or I'm saying evidence matters as a part of the story. I don't think you can simply assume it's a scientific natural law. Evidence has got to be multifaceted, triangulated by different sources, and then, you know, made as transparent to the public as you feel is politically sustainable, and timing will be a part of that. You know, I think that the other extreme, you know, without evidence, where I think public servants probably struggle the most, is where it is just partisan politics. You know, it's very hard to it's not a fun government to work for if, as much if it's just going to be based on a purely value-based parish pump sort of a constituency-based party, which I'm not claiming anyways, but that's the other extreme.
I'll say the assumption the question is, of course, valid, and evidence can be contested, and one wants to accumulate a variety of different evidence resources. I think part of the core of my presentation was that there are some quite large policy areas where we have chosen not to accumulate evidence. Not bring evidence to bear, so it's not contested evidence, it's there's no evidence. And second, that to the extent that there might be small bits of evidence, we have chosen not to make it transparent. We have chosen not to put it in the public domain for the purposes of political discussion and assessment and the debate over competing evidence that I think you're encouraging.
Any other final comments? I'm getting you have time for one more, Andrea? You're the boss. All right, one more question.
Hi, my name's Sean Panambulum. I'm actually a student in the Faculty of Science here at McGill. So when I hear all this talk that evidence isn't at the forefront of decision-making, it kind of makes me want to tear my hair out. And, you know, the more I attend activist lectures and environmental lectures on things like power science projects, the more I hear from groups like the Indigenous Environmental Network telling me that the people in NGOs and in policy-producing structures are not in touch with people on the front line or the communities on the front line, and that the policies that they're producing are not really relevant, representative of their needs. And I think, Greg, you talked about a lack of social knowledge on the part of politicians. And I would argue that there's a massive, massive lack of knowledge on the part of the people who are presenting the evidence to politicians to make decisions. And the gentleman talked about competing evidence and just evidence presentation to the politicians in general. And I think if the people who are presenting the evidence to the politicians are not on the ground involved in some way with the actual social situation that are supposed to be addressing with these policies, I think there's a big, big, big problem. And I was wondering if the panel could address that.
Quick file on this one.
No, I think it's true. You know, people, if scientists say something, the local knowledge is counterintuitive, sort of the points Matthew were making, it won't resonate, it won't have credibility. You know, I think that is, so sometimes it may not end up in scrutiny of real local knowledge. I think it's a legitimate concern.
A risky thing to say, but local knowledge is not always accurate. The proponents of local knowledge are not always reliable. One of the reasons I think that the instinct of politicians is important in a process persisted because it may help them sort through the validity or not of advice they receive from people who no doubt are on the front lines. Whether they're rooted in the front lines is sometimes another question.
If not, I'd like to ask you to join me in thanking our panel and remind you that we'll see again at 11:15.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Chris. I'd like to thank the panel for raising questions that we'll be looking at for the rest of the day. We're going to be talking about policymaking in crisis, who makes decisions on what basis, and we're going to be talking about media and public opinion and how that affects policymaking as well. We're now going to go into our coffee break, which is just in the main lobby outside. The men's room are near the club room, but the ladies can use the lady lounge on the second floor. Please be promptly back here at 11:15. Bring your coffee if you must. Thanks very much.